there quite a lot of discussion here about what was going to be the title of our first talk. And we had various ideas. And I came up with this, The Path of Joy. And somebody who is perhaps newer to us said to me, well, aren't you deceiving them a little bit? Bringing them here under false, perhaps bringing them here under false pretenses. And of course, we all know that actually our lives aren't never going to be totally honey-licking from the moment we get up to the moment we go to bed. You know, that is obviously, we know that in our hearts. And of course, a Buddhist path isn't going to change our day-to-day realities, if you like. But hopefully, we'll see tonight that it can perhaps change the way we look at our lives and experience our lives, and that the underneath can be thus a deep sense of at least contentment that comes through the training. And it reminded me of an anecdote, of a little story, which allows me also to tell a little bit about the founding of Shobwan, which Gary just mentioned. And it concerns this little bag here, and you won't immediately guess what it is. When our temple was opened, which, as Gary said, was in 1984, a monk, head monk, Asoka Morinaga Roshi, came over from Japan with, I think it was 7 monks, to formally open the temple and also to ordain Master Dayu, who had actually done her training as a lay woman. And they saved up money. Various people helped to pay for that visit in Japan. Various of his congregation came together to support it financially. And there was one lady who didn't have any money and couldn't afford to contribute. And it was said that she made 100 of these little bags instead to provide for us. And they were going to be called happiness bags. Right? And Sokoroshi then presented them to the group. But he said that he'd actually changed the name. And when he was flying over from Japan, he decided to call them grumble bags. He said, to be truly happy, we need something to do with our grumbles. And therefore, we have these little bags, which we still have some of them, and we can put our grumbles in them. And then that allows the heart that freedom. And it may sound, in a way, quite a sort of trivial example, in a way, but it does actually, hopefully we'll see, point to something about how a way of looking at our lives, at least. And also just to say about that lady also, actually, who made these bags, that act of service that she gave when she actually made them, that is, in a way, the heart of it. It's something about that attitude of not looking inward towards myself, but seeing how I can contribute to the world that I am part of. And sometimes when we hear the word religion, we can, in fact, we're sometimes told, aren't we, we don't mention that word. You know, it might put people off. You hear that in some quarters. Well, but that's, of course, if we don't really understand what a religion actually is. It's our ideas about it. And if we just look at the word religion, it means religio in the Latin, which means linking back to who we are. Starting to feel really connected with the lives that we are living. And that's what our Buddhist training is all about. It's about that re-linking back into something that we're very familiar with on one hand, but on the other hand are very busy, in some sense, distracting ourselves from. Well, the Dalai Lama said quite a lot about happiness, hasn't he? He's only written a book on happiness. And he very much says, of course, that it's totally natural to want to be happy. You know? And of course it is, isn't it? You know, who would want to go anywhere with the purpose of not being happy? You know, you wouldn't, would you? So it's totally natural. But it's just about how we think we're going to make ourselves happy, isn't it? What we think actually is going to make us happy. I even heard at the moment that Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I think, is with the Dalai Lama. And there's this, you know, the subject of their conversation, I think it's a 5-day visit, is actually joy. And so it's, you know, it's obviously is actually what spiritual people want to talk about. And there's a rather nice little anecdote about I think they were Christian monks who were having a conversation together, and they were asked sort of what they talk about to people. And they said, well, when we talk to our practitioners, we talk about their worries and their suffering and their problems. But amongst ourselves, we talk about joy. So actually, the heart of it, of any religious practice, is this: is that actual the joy in the heart, a natural joy. not something contrived, but something that just comes naturally, gradually, through a spiritual practice. So we're going to look a little bit about, you know, what it is that we do to make ourselves happy. And for that, we have a story, which, as Gary said, I don't know. Well, actually, this one started in the Buddhist Sati some years ago. And it was a bhikkhu, Mahaboa, who went there to give a talk, who was from the forest Thai tradition. And this is a story that was told in his talk, which we quite often tell amongst ourselves. And it's called the Golden Bull story. And he was recounting a situation where a monk is sitting in his kuti in meditation, and there he is, you know, very concentrated, trying to settle his mind, maybe a bit distracted, and then he calms down. And then suddenly his little golden ball starts jumping up and down a little bit in front of him. And I bet he tried hard to resist it. He thought, no, I'm in doing my meditation, I won't be distracted, but this little golden ball was just very enticing, jumping up and down. So he couldn't really help himself, and he eventually got up from his little meditation cushion and starts following that, trying to get hold of that golden ball. But that little golden ball just hops gently further away from him, so he has to go a bit further. And soon the golden ball is leading him on a jolly little dance. And he's going off down the forest paths, going off into the forest. And this little golden ball, always that little bit, jumping up and down a little bit in front of him. And eventually they got into the thick of the forest, and the golden ball suddenly went up a tree. And the little monk started climbing up that tree after the golden ball. And it said that he went right out, this golden ball went right out onto a far limb of that tree. And the monks following him. And when it comes to the end of the branch, and the monk's leaning his hand out to get that golden ball, the golden ball disappears. Suddenly the monk comes to himself, and he's totally frightened because he's found himself in this very wobbly limb of a tree deep in the forest in the night. He doesn't know what to do. So he cries out, and nobody hears him because it's the middle of the night or whatever, and he has to wait till morning. Then one of his fellow monks hears him, comes and clambers up the tree and helps him get down again. And the Venerable Mahaboa, apparently, when he told that story, apparently he was chewing betel nuts, which they do in his tradition. He was spitting them into his platoon. And he said, and it serves him right for letting his heart get away from him like that. Mm-hmm. And that is what we do, isn't it, with our things that we follow. Those things that look like they'll just be absolutely bring us satisfaction apart in some way. And we follow them, and then maybe we get them. Maybe it's a new home, or a new job, or a new partner, or something that we've really thought would bring us some. Just if only, it's when we have only that one thing, isn't it? Only I had that one thing, then my life would be blissful. And I have to say, when I was, as I came into Zen training, I started out. I had a job that involved quite a bit of travelling and a lot of desk work. And I remember thinking to myself when I started the training, this is not the right place to train. I can't train if I'm always travelling and if I'm doing desk work. Because they told me the training's very physical, you need to use your body. So I thought, no, this won't do. You know, I'll have to get another situation to do this spiritual training. It can't be, you know, in this one. So then I had the good fortune to be invited by Venerable Mukheni to come and train in Shōwan. I thought, yeah, great. And took the plunge. And then a few weeks I found myself thinking, all she makes me do is manual work. You know, my brain is going to go to sleep. This won't be a good place to really, you know, come to any understanding. And eventually, a few weeks later, the penny sort of dropped. That actually, you know, it was just the mind deciding, you know, making those decisions about what is a good place to train and what is not a good place to train. And of course, actually, any place is a perfect place for doing a training that relieves the heart and starts to open us up, put us into contact with how our lives really are. So to look at this a little bit, actually I'll have one more example, just thinking about this religious life and how we, in a sense, we're always distracting ourselves from our normal lives, always going after one desire or another desire, or not just being able just to sit perhaps a little bit quietly with ourselves. I'm thinking about sort of why we do this for a reason, don't we? Those fears that are underneath it. And the practice being, spiritual practice being, to allow us to come aware of those things, those grumbles. We can't actually just put them in a bag until we first of all have come into contact with them and seen actually what those grumbles are. Otherwise it's not possible to put them in a bag and tie the bag up. So this is a little anecdote really, but it just shows how we can really close ourselves off when we do, how we close ourselves off from my personal experience. And it was some years ago now, and I was going on an outing from, I was living here, and I was sent out to do an outing one morning. And if you live in Shobhan, you can't just have a coffee or a tea whenever you want one. It's one of those little things we do just to make it a little bit tighter here. Can't just go and make yourself a cup of coffee, which is sort of quite a small thing, but if you live here all the time, occasionally you think, oh, it'd be nice to have a cup of coffee. Anyway, so I had this outing one morning, and I thought, lovely, you know, I'll be able to. Going down to a certain place, plenty of time. I was really looking forward to this little cafe I was going to go to. You know how you make all those pictures, don't we? And we're making all those lovely pictures, that lovely cup of coffee, you know, that nice sit down I was going to have in that cafe. And then I got to do the particular assignment, which was supposed to be quite straightforward, but of course, when there's a strong desire in the background, they never are they? And it took about much, much longer than I had imagined it would. And I was sort of just making my way back, still trying to work out whether I had time or not to stop for this cup of coffee. And eventually I remembered the training. I thought, well, actually, should actually let this one go at this point. It will make me late for lunch. And so I just thought, okay, forget the coffee. And that minute, the day suddenly became a beautiful spring day. It's like the flowers suddenly came into bloom. It was spring. Suddenly it all opened up. It's like it hadn't been there for the whole morning. It hadn't been there at all. And suddenly, that beautiful day, it was a sunny day, the trees were all coming green, there was some blossom around. Suddenly, it was all there. And where it had been 5 minutes before, when you were tied down with that desire that we have for just to get that one thing. It was a real sort of little eye-opener. And of course, we do that to ourselves all the time, don't we, when we're distracting ourselves in some way or other, rather than just actually being prepared to open up and see what's right in front of us. So to look at what we say, we talk about training. In fact, in a way, it's a rather difficult word. I think we've got a couple of Japanese people here tonight, and the word they use in Japan is shugyo. It actually translate directly into English. There isn't a word that quite captures it. But it is a sense of a spiritual undertaking, a practice. We do tend to use the word training, but it's not, obviously it has a devotional aspect rather than being a training that you do in a gym or something. It has a different connotation than that. And if we go right back to the original teachings, and as Gary said, these things go right the way back, and what we teach here does go right the way back to the Buddha's own words and time. And he referred to a threefold training. And the threefold training had three aspects to it. And the first one is discipline. I'll obviously go through to explain these in a little more depth. But the first one was discipline. The second one is translated as meditation. But it's not meditation as just in terms of a sitting practice, but as something that goes on throughout our daily lives. And the third one is insight or wisdom. And he said spiritual training has those three aspects. And if we decide we like one of them and ignore the other two, or like two of them and ignore one, then it cannot flow. We have to have those three aspects. It's like a three-legged stool. If you take one leg away, it won't stand up. Likewise, the spiritual path has those three components to it. So to look at the first one, discipline, it's obviously not a word that we really like. Even restraint, discipline, not sure. Don't immediately think that's what I'm going to make me happy, do we really? So it's good to really look at the word, and actually, it actually means something quite natural. It's actually, apparently in translation, has that connotation of a natural thing. There's not somehow this straitjacket that we somehow put ourselves in, but it's actually going back to a natural kind of restraint that we already have some knowledge of but tend to ignore when we're driven by these passions from the outside. And we want to think of a few situations which actually show us this very natural state of when we choose to take on some kind of discipline, but actually it's bringing us back to something that is natural and is known to us. And it may be even something like getting out of bed at a certain time rather than getting out of bed whenever I feel like getting out of bed. If we do get out of bed at a certain time, it actually can be make our day much more easy to fall into place, can't it, than if we just get up whenever I feel like it. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Oh, I get up whenever I want. Sounds nice, but actually we know even from people who have certain mental health problems, for example, that actually those little things which are little restraints, little disciplines, actually can really provide a support and a framework for our lives. So these things are actually natural, but they don't feel natural. You know, they are natural when we come back to it, but of course when we start doing them, if we're used to doing things whenever we want, it feels very unnatural to suddenly start doing certain disciplines. And I had one example from somebody who, when she came to us, she used to be quite slouchy. I bet I did too when I first came here too, by the way. But she particularly, when she came here more recently, used to be quite slouchy, sitting in a soppy kind of way. And so she just received instructions that she should maybe put a little bit of effort into actually holding a bit of good form, a little bit more than she was perhaps used to. And she came back a few weeks later and she said, I feel very odd when I'm in the pub with my friends. Now I'm sitting up straight. She said, it doesn't feel right. And I had a small bet with myself and her, actually, that her friends probably didn't really notice. But actually it was her inside that felt quite awkward because she was used to probably, sitting however it was. And actually just sitting with a little bit of behaviour, deportment, I suppose is the word for it, felt very unnatural to her. But as we start to cultivate these things, of course they become natural. They start off feeling unnatural, but they can quite quickly, in fact, become a natural way of being. I remember as another a small example when we enter into this path, we're encouraged not to listen to the radio and drive as a practice, because obviously it can be quite distracting if you're driving along and you're avidly engaged in the radio, and it'll add a bit of focus on the driving. So I have practiced that, and more recently I've been on holiday. I thought, I'll just try and see, maybe I'll listen to something, shh, don't look at me. Listen to something as we're driving, I'll turn on the radio. And it just felt all wrong. It was really interesting. And I have done it since, thinking, I'll listen to something. But there's something about it, because you've cultivated a different attitude. And so even though one's on holiday and one might, be tempted to do those things, sometimes it's become so hard to sort of change what actually makes it feel at easiness. And there's a rather nice little story going right the way back to the Buddhist times about a disciple of the Buddha's called Mahakashyapa. And he was an old man. He was one of the most senior disciples of the Buddha. And he became an old man, but he developed a lifestyle with a lot of what would appear to be quite austere practices. So he lived quite a long way from the village, and he didn't have many clothes or whatever. He had quite a very simple life. And so the Buddha went to Mahakashyapa and said, you've really put in a lot during the years. I think it's now time that if you could actually take things a little bit easier, go and live a little bit nearer the village, have a few more, comforts, maybe get yourself some more clothes, and live a slightly easier lifestyle. And Mahakashyapa said, well, yes, blessed one, if that's what you would want of me, certainly I will move nearer the village and live a more comfortable life. But if you leave it up to me, I'm actually comfortable the way I'm living, and I'd rather stay here and live the way I am living. And so, of course, the Buddha said, very good, Mahakashyapa, then please stay as you are. He didn't say I must, that I must be allowed to stay here, of course. Mahakashyapa said, I would like to see what actually feels most comfortable. And so those so-called disciplines that can look quite what worrying or off-putting from when we first hear about them actually can become really comfortable parts of just the way we do things. So that's the discipline, the aspect, the restraint, if you like. But it's a natural thing, so we can take the word in its best possible sense, that deportment, that's like good behaviour, in the way that we're absolutely, in the deepest sense, we do know, you know, in certain situations how to behave. And it's developing a form that allows us to behave in the way that we actually know is a good human way to behave. And it's giving us a form, a container, a way of being that allows us to function like that. So that's the first of these three aspects of the training. And the second one is, I translated it as meditation. But it's not meditation just sitting on a cushion quietly. This meditation actually is being totally at one with our lives, totally at one with what's actually taking place. And of course it said that only a full enlightened Buddha could do this 24 hours a day. So for the rest of us, we're cultivating something, we're cultivating that openness and being at one with our daily lives. And it's said to have three aspects to it. And the first one is effort, putting in some effort into our endeavours, taking them seriously, with good intention. And the second one is awareness. And awareness is actually a translation of the word nowadays, which we hear a lot about. We hear a lot about this mindfulness, don't we, which is another word. We tend to prefer the word awareness because it actually gives a more sense of the body being actually open and engaged in what is actually taking place. And if we like to think, well, actually, how do we... We might think, well, I am aware. You know, I'm aware through my days. You know? Perhaps. So it's good to perhaps think, well, in what sense are we not aware? You know? And there's a rather nice cartoon that we used to have here, sort of depicting how things can actually be in our lives. And it had a piece of paper divided into four quadrants. And the first one had a man, I think, sitting in his office doing his paperwork. But you could see a little thought bubble, and the thought bubble was his holiday at the week. Where he was going at the weekend was in the thought bubble. And then underneath it you had the where he went at the weekend. And I think he was maybe on the beach somewhere having a nice time. But in the thought bubble, he was thinking about the fact that he really should be mowing his lawn. And so the next quadrant, you had him mowing his lawn. But in that case, he was thinking about his beautiful wife who wasn't there right now. And then I think the final quadrant had him in his arms of his beautiful wife, thinking about what he needs to do at the office. And we're really honest. I mean, we're all like that, aren't we? We really look forward to a situation. In fact, in a way, it's one of the things that brought me into the training. I remember sitting in a concert once, a musical concert. You know, spent the evening, you know, set the evening aside, bought the tickets, got to the concert, couldn't listen to the music properly. You know, and the thing is, this is ridiculous. You know, you've paid all that money, come to this place, set the time evening aside, and you get there and you find your mind's on other things and you can't listen to the concert. And that's, you know, and actually, you know, it does take quite a lot of practice. Certainly, it has done for me, and to get to the point where actually we can put aside whatever it is, and actually listen to the music or open up to the beauty of the day or whatever. Because those things easily crowd us in, don't they? And we're continually having to go back within our training and actually clear them out again. So that awareness, that openness, that being with what is actually being done right now. And people sometimes laugh at some of the stories, that the talks that we give, because they say we're always talking about doing the ironing, brushing teeth, and doing the washing up. And there's a little bit of, it's not totally true, but there's a little bit of truth in it, because actually these are the details of our daily lives, yeah, and they're actually where we're encouraged to start cultivating that awareness and that openness to what's going on. Because of course we ignore the daily things that are going on, you know, because of some higher ideas we have, then we can't really be open to it. And there's a rather nice story of a monk who was going to listen to a priest who was going to listen to a talk by another priest, and one of his students, acolytes, said to him, you know, well, you must be really looking forward to that talk. He's known to be a really good speaker. And the priest said, no, no. He said, what I'm going to see is how he ties his shoelaces. I was careful not to wear any saying that. But actually, no, it is the details. It's not, it is, you know, what the man could talk. We can give lovely talks, perhaps, or not nice talks. But actually, it isn't what really counts. It's actually what the practice is going on behind it. So that awareness, and that awareness we can, which we cultivate with things that we like and then and things that we don't like. And what we learn through, for example, being here is when people spend some time here, and there's a few people here, you can welcome to sound them out afterwards, and you know, please do talk to them. But actually we get given things to do pretty much throughout the day, and we don't get the chance to say, well, actually that's not one thing I don't like doing. You know? In fact, people never say that because they're worried you might give it to them. and you know, or something that they really like doing. I mean, of course, you give them a jobs that they'll be able to do, but you give them a range of jobs according to what needs doing, not what they may feel like they want to do. And you give them to them in the way that they normally get done here, and not the way they might like to do them. And of course, that builds up a certain strength, because then we can do the thing that needs doing when it needs doing, and not always have to be sort of manipulating our lives to sort of avoid the things that we don't like or put them off or whatever, because we don't like the uncomfortableness of the feeling of doing it. So we do sometimes talk about some of those very normal everyday tasks, and that we can give it a try, just turning off the radio and actually putting ourselves right into that task and seeing whether it really feels the same, or whether we don't get a little bit of joy out of actually doing it with a wholehearted spirit. Be surprised what things that we thought we really didn't like doing, if we really put our hearts into it, you know, give it an experiment at least just once. Something that we really think we don't like doing it with a wholehearted spirit, and then honestly afterwards say whether it really felt as boring or whatever as we imagined it with. Very revealing. We think it's just our hobbies that we like doing, but of course we like doing our hobbies because we actually do naturally put our hearts into our hobbies. We can cultivate that same lightness of heart with other things if we give it a good try and put ourselves into it. So that's that awareness, and then the awareness comes out of that in a sense, that being simply being able to be open to what is actually going on, and if we get distracted, to be able to come back to it and actually again be open and present with what's actually around us. And of course that means that there'll be things which are pleasant and things that are unpleasant that come up naturally out of that. We don't say that this path of joy is actually only involves the things that are, the awareness of things that are pleasant, of course. But it means the things that we consider that might seem unpleasant are opened up to and born in a much more wholehearted spirit, a much more open spirit, a much more tolerant spirit. So they don't have to put us off and leave us feeling very deflated or whatever, because we know that's part of the round and we can endure it much more willingly and openly. So the last element is the insight, that of this threefold training is the insight or the wisdom, and that's the wisdom to actually see our lives as they are, rather than so much behind those pink sort of spectacles of what I like and what I don't like and how I see the world. And of course we have that natural insight anyway. We have that natural insight which makes us want to follow a spiritual path of whatever sort we follow. That comes out of that natural insight that just getting what I want all the time doesn't actually satisfy the heart. And actually giving ourselves to things and giving ourselves to people and being of service, we find does fulfill the heart. So that knowledge is a natural wisdom, but as we deepen our practice, that there's a chance to be even a deeper sense of just awareness of what needs doing, when it needs doing. You know, a little less tendency to meddle. Sometimes we want to help, don't we? And then we go meddling, and things backfire on us. And that insight, that wisdom is the wisdom to actually see when we should play a part, when we should do something, when we should hold back, even when we should perhaps do something that might look less kind. Sometimes, oh, there, you poor thing. Okay, that's not always the kindest response, is it, to somebody? It might be that they need a good kick for some reason, yeah? Or a bit of a bestirring. And that insight wisdom is what we see, obviously, in our Zen masters, is they don't always ladle us with honey, do you know? They actually do what fits the situation, and that's through that having emptied out their hearts, so they can actually see what actually is going to be most helpful in the situation that's in front of them. So I was going to say a few words about sort of my own journey in terms of this what we call it the path of joy. And joy, I should say, actually is one of the factors of enlightenment. So the Buddha did. In his teaching, said that joy is actually integral to the path of a journey towards that liberation of heart. And without that, cultivating that joyful attitude, it's a natural joy rather than something that we have to somehow create. It's a joy that just comes through the act of being of service and having laying down some of that burden of all things that I think I want and all the way that the world should be and all those kinds of things. As we put them aside, then that lightness and sense of goodwill can arise. And well, there are some people here who knew me at the very start of when I started training. And I came into it with a whole lot of mental anguish, where it was a very much a mental set of mental problems that sort of drew me in, I suppose, and drew me to start practicing. And you know, sort of reflecting on it a little bit for this talk, I suppose what happened sort of being here wasn't that I was given kind of honey pills to make these things go away, but I was given an opportunity to simply to endure them to the point where they became no longer really of importance. It's just like sitting with them and allowing the other aspects of life to become more important. So being here became much more important than what was going on in my brain and head and mind or whatever. Those things just became less and less important. They still came up, they still arose, but they just didn't have the sort of power. I suppose it was the resistance to them, pushing them away gradually, very gradually decreased. And it was very much due to the dreaded word discipline of being here, where you couldn't say, oh, well, I don't feel up to it today, I'm really sorry, but I've really got a headache, you know. Don't think I can manage today, or I really didn't sleep well last night, you know. Please can I have the day off? Hasn't worked yet anyway. You know, it doesn't, obviously if someone's really sick, that's totally a different case. But if they, you know, got some kind of emotional disturbance going on, then they're required to go on. And that gives one the strength, in fact. Because it means that no thing no longer has hold over one. As long as one gives in to some of those things. Oh, I really didn't sleep well last night, I really can't come into work today, or whatever it is, then we're giving that thing power over us. But if we have that chance to endure it, then out of that does come a sort of contentment, a sort of tolerance towards whatever it is. And of course it can, that's my own particular, my own particular sort of problem. You know, we all think our own problem is very special, don't we? You know, that's my problem. But of course when we look at these things closely, they actually have all got similar. They've got the same roots to them. They're, you know, they're based on those fears and not wanting certain things, and that very strong sense of me being a separate, rather special being, you know, rather separate from the world around us. And they've all got that common aspect to them, which is why, of course, we can relate to each other. You know, we can understand each other because actually we do all have those common roots to our concerns and worries that are underneath it. So I guess, you know, it's a lot about actually cultivating that strength that we can act in situations that we like and in situations that we don't like. And that does bring a natural sense of joy because we're no longer having to run away from certain things that we think might be unpleasant. We're actually able to, whatever's going on, whether we consider it pleasant or unpleasant, actually able to participate. And our own personal preferences just get less say. Of course, in certain situations, we're allowed to choose, and then we can enjoy it greatly. But we can also have a contentment even when we don't get the thing that we think we really can't live without. Well, life can still have a sense of peacefulness about it. And I think probably thinking more recently about now, about what I think about that feeling of joy, that path of joy, you know, reflecting, having given up, having set this title, just reflecting on it. And I think there's just something about being in the presence of a spiritual training. It is very warming for the heart, you know, that sense of walking the Buddha's path. And of course it can be other spiritual trainings, of course we don't think it's uniquely the Buddha's path in this sense, but being part of a way that is showing us things that go totally beyond what I think and what I want or whatever, has a warming aspect, when the heart can be very cold and isolated by its desires and fears, and that cuts us right off. And the path that sort of opens us up and says, right, you know, we are all deeply connected, and this is how we can practice giving ourselves to our lives and being of service to others. It's just the warmth that allows just to bubble away. It doesn't mean to say we don't have our day-to-day concerns and problems, of course. That wouldn't be the way. And if we want just to round things off, maybe think a little bit about the Buddha himself, who obviously reopened this path. He rediscovered an ancient way to an ancient city, walked this path and opened it up for us. And of course he didn't go through a life without any problems or without any pains. We know he did. We went through some very austere practices before he obtained his insight, but even afterwards he had headaches and he was supposed to have died of stomach complaints and what have you. But he certainly wouldn't have added anything to it. He wouldn't have said, oh, it's so unfair, I get stomach pains. You know? That's the bits that we add, isn't it, to our... Not, the Buddha's way is never going to avoid us having headaches and stomach aches ever again, I'm afraid, or whatever. But it does teach us not to add those extra grumbles. You know? It allows us to put them aside and just have the uncomfortableness of a headache or a stomach ache or whatever it may be, or an emotional issue, without having to add that extra weight to it. So he walked the way to open it up, to show us how to guide us. And even just looking at Buddha statues, you can get that some kind of sense of that serenity. And if we actually look at joy within the teachings, it comes along with calm, meditation, and equanimity, the four things that form the latter part of this. The seven factors of enlightenment, and the last four are these ones, which we obviously can see if we look at a Buddha image. It gives us that sense. In fact, it can be even a meditation practice just to look within certain traditions, to look at the Buddha and just contemplate what he might speak for our hearts. And for Buddhists, there's actually three things that we particularly, we take refuge. We take refuge, we take succour in those three things, and it's the Buddha and the Buddha and his life and what he represents. And of course, he represents something in our own hearts. We don't have to see it as somehow worshipping an idol outside, but it's representing something that is actually part of how we are. You know, that calmness and serenity is within us, that joy and equanimity, likewise, they're things that are within our own hearts. So we take refuge in the Buddha, and then we take refuge in the Dharma, which is those teachings, the law, the way things are, and as Gary said, those teachings that have been carefully passed down, and hopefully will continue to be carefully passed down by all those who practice these things and keep them alive and make them current for the times in which we live. And then it's the community. It's the community that we're part of and practice with, which in the sense of perhaps is actually the most important. It's the current community. It is the way. We cannot do it. We cannot practice these things. There are very few people who can practice these things alone. And so we practice as part of a community, and that brings that tremendous warmth of being able to share, of being able to see others experiencing the same problems that we have or whatever, to give guidance to others, to be training with others, alongside each other, which brings that tremendous warmth of heart. So I think I'll leave it here and see whether there are any questions, and then we have a few refreshments lined up for anybody who is able to stay.